Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your lunch. Fantastic to hear so much conversation and networking going on. If we could just have some quiet, please. Thank you. I would now like to welcome Dr. Marion Kohler, Head of Economic Analysis, to the stage, who's going to tell you about the RBA's forecasts. After that, I will be back up here to facilitate the Q&A, so please come up with lots of fantastic questions for Marion. We'll be back shortly.
Just need to get my glasses out. Getting old. Okay, welcome. Here we go. Thank you very much for coming today. My colleague Lucy Ellis has been unable to come for personal reasons, and she asked me to step in today. And I just have to say I'm delighted to do so. It's great to be with you in Perth after such a long time when we couldn't be together. As you would know, the Reserve Bank Board met yesterday here at the Western Australian office of the bank. The Governor discussed the monetary policy decision last night, so I'm not going to repeat that discussion today. Instead, I'm going to talk about the forecast that we presented to the Board yesterday, which informed their decision. The details of those forecasts will be published on Friday in the Statement of Monetary Policy. Today, I'm going to preview some of the highlights of those forecasts and provide some context to them. Before I get to those details, I'd like to talk about why and how central banks forecast. I will also make some observations about some principles we need to observe when we forecast. So, why do central banks forecast? Forecasts are a key tool for central bank decision making. It takes time for monetary policy to affect economic activity and inflation. These so-called long and variable lags of monetary policy mean that central banks need to have a view on how the economy will be tracking in future. Financial factors, including the exchange rate, asset prices, and borrowing behavior, respond soonest to change in policy interest rates. Next comes real activity, followed by the labour market, and finally, inflation. It takes a while for these effects to flow right through the economy. Economic models give us some guide on how long we might expect these lags to be. Here is one of our models. It's called MARTIN. I don't actually remember anymore what the abbreviation stands for, but it is a full system economic model. In this model, a higher cash rate, which you can see in the first panel, starts flowing through to GDP relatively quickly. But as you can see in the second panel, the peak effect is only around 1.5 years later. The lower level of economic activity translates into an increase in the unemployment rate, with a peak effect at around 2 years after the policy rate change. And that's the third panel you can see here. Inflation is the last to move, with a peak effect at a little over 2 years. The timing and magnitude of the effects varies between models and over time, and the estimates are typically imprecise. But the results from MARTIN are very broadly consistent with other models that we also look at. In line with these lags, our forecasts typically cover the coming 2.5 years, just to go beyond that 2 years and a bit. In recent years, things have turned out very differently from our earlier forecasts. With that in mind, it's important to be clear about what our forecasts are and what they are not. They are not pure predictions of the future. Rather, they are an indicative tool for decision making. If the projected path for inflation and other variables is not consistent with the bank's inflation target, that points to a need for a different path for the cash rate. And with a different path for policy, the outcomes will obviously differ from earlier forecasts. But neither is this a simple formula whereby policy can be mechanically set so that the forecast for inflation is always exactly at the target. For a start, we also have a mandate for full employment. And there can be a trade-off between the two in the short term. There are also a range of uncertainties around the forecast that we need to bear in mind. These risks aren't always evenly balanced, although it can be difficult to assess, except with hindsight. Shocks happen, and and economic structures evolve. That means there is inherent uncertainty about where you are now and how much you need to change policy to get to your desired result. These considerations speak to the need for both policymakers and the public to see the forecasts as more than just a set of numerical predictions for specific outcomes such as inflation or unemployment. Surrounding these point forecasts are a range of judgments and risk assessments. These can be set out qualitatively as a discussion of risks and uncertainties, and we do that in each issue of the statement. Or they can be expressed quantitatively as bands around the central forecast. These bands capture the range of past deviations of outcomes from our forecasts, coming from all sources of variation and uncertainties. I'll show those graphs a little later. We also can and do show particular scenarios. Either way, these are just as much part of the forecasts as that numerical central forecast. They help articulate our thinking about how we would interpret signs that things are turning out differently from the central scenario. For example, in the February statement, the one just passed, we explored how outright declines in goods prices would affect our outlook for inflation. Another reason why we shouldn't think of our central scenario as a true prediction, let alone a promise, is that it is predicated on paths for the cash rate and the exchange rate that are based on market expectations, rather than the board's prediction. I'll talk about these assumptions a bit more in a moment, but the main point to take away is that even if those assumptions don't accord with your own view, a central scenario built on some plausible path of future path is still a useful tool for decision making. So to summarise, central banks forecast because monetary policy acts with a lag, but forecasts are not predictions. So how do we forecast? Predicting the future is hard, and it is even harder if you don't know entirely where you are starting from. That is, when we make forecasts, we do not have comprehensive data on economic activity in the period just past. There is necessarily a lag between when something happens and when that something is compiled into an economic statistic and published. For example, our current forecasts here in early May are based on official data on unemployment and inflation for March. But we don't know yet about April, and we don't know what economic growth in the March quarter was until early next month. There are several ways to address these data gaps and get a better sense of what state current economic conditions are in now when you commence forecasting. This activity is sometimes known as nowcasting. One approach is to combine different partial data, which includes data from the ABS and from private providers, administrative and survey data, and the extensive range of information we collect via our liaison. All of this can be used to estimate the current and most recent periods for broader measures of economic outcomes. At the Reserve Bank, our liaison program is an important input into our nowcasting. Speaking to businesses as well as community services and other organisations across the country gives us a live, if partial, read on current conditions. Another benefit of these conversations is that we gain insight into the why, the things that are driving people's decisions, what they are concerned about, and how they might react if things change. This gives us an insight into the near future as well as the current period. Once we get much beyond the current period, things get a bit more complex. There are no real-time indicators for periods that haven't happened. Some leading indicators help predict outcomes several quarters in advance. But for the most part, we must rely on economic relationships and our understanding of the data to construct a forecast. For these relationships, you need a model. Ideally, you have multiple models. All models involve simplifications, and different simplifying assumptions can yield different results. It's therefore prudent to cross-check against multiple models to ensure your forecast is as robust as possible. Where feasible, that's been our approach at the Reserve Bank. For example, our main inflation forecast system takes the average of four different types of models. We also can cross-check against whole economy models. Models don't always serve you well, though, when forecasting. Judgment is also necessary. Sometimes that is because something unprecedented has happened, like the COVID-19 pandemic. Models are estimated on past data, so they can't handle something that never happened in data we have to hand. Other times, one of the simplifying assumptions in your model, like the importance of supply shocks, lead the model astray. A clear example of this is for inflation. Most inflation models best capture demand-driven inflation. Historically, these drivers have been the most important for explaining the persistent component of inflation. During most of the inflation targeting era, supply shocks have tended to be benign or favourable to managing inflation. But we know supply-side disruptions have added a lot to inflation over the past couple of years. We can get an indication of the contribution from supply disruptions when we look at a model. Here, we look at the gap between actual outcomes for, this is core inflation, true mean inflation, and what a model tuned to demand factors would tell us. In this exercise, we take the outcomes for the unemployment rate, inflation expectations, and import prices as given. And you can see here, even if we had known these outcomes in advance, these kinds of models significantly underpredicted recent inflation. So the model is what the blue bars are. That's the demand-driven model. It's just one of many. You can do the exercise with different ones. But you can see the differences to the red. That's the supply shocks implied in the outcomes. This type of analysis helps us understand the past. And it also helps us inform the judgment needed to account for these less common events in our forecasts. And you can see here that graph has a forecast period attached, and when we kind of pull that exercise forward, that's the decomposition we get into demand and supply on what our current forecast would tell us. So it helps us inform the judgment needed to account for these less common events in our forecasts. This is also an example of why having a narrative around the forecasts is so important. We also need to make some technical assumptions when we have a model. Within any set of forecasts, there's always some factors that must be taken as given. Either they can't be modelled easily, or there's little benefit in doing so. One example is the global outlook. Australia is a relatively small economy, so nothing we do here with monetary policy affects the rest of the world in any material sense. So we take the global growth outlook as given when we put our forecasts together. In addition, for most countries, we do not prepare our own forecasts. Instead, we largely rely on the consensus panel of forecasts. The exception to that is China, where we have developed our own analytical capability, including in our team working on the ground in Beijing. The most consequential assumptions we need to make are for the path for the cash rate and the exchange rate. These need to be considered together. There's a large and long-standing literature showing that the best forecast you can make for the exchange rate is whatever level it is today. So that's what we do. Having made this assumption for the exchange rate, we can then come to the cash rate assumption. We want to have a coherent set of forecasts that are consistent with each other. So we need to use the future path of interest rates that market participants have in mind when they're trading in financial markets, and so also determining the exchange rate. That points us in the direction of using the path implied by OIS overnight index swap rates. Market pricing can, though, sometimes become volatile. So, as a practical matter, since February last year, that forecast round, we've taken the average of the OIS rates and the cash rate forecasts of market economists. There are other approaches we could take, such as assuming a path implied by an economic model or the board's own expectations. Some central banks do it that way. But doing so can be interpreted as a commitment or a promise that is not robust to changing circumstances. It's important for you to do continuous improvement when you're forecasting. Learning from the past is important for ensuring we deliver the best forecasts we can make. Each year, a review of the accuracy of our economic forecasts is presented to the board. We assess what we have learned about the economy and about our own forecasting approach. We are also constantly looking for other ways to improve how we forecast. This includes tapping into new sources of information and data, and also looking at new models and techniques. So I walked you through the kind of three ingredients: nowcasts, models, and assumptions, and at the end, learnings, continuous improvement of your forecasting. So let's turn to our forecasts. The first step of the forecasting process is an exercise in answering the question, are things turning out as you expected? Given the large and rapid increase in the cash rate over the past year, a large part of the answer turns on whether the economy is responding as expected to that shift in policy. And in the main, to date it has. There have been some changes in the economy over the pandemic that are influencing the transmission of policy. For the most part, though, the usual relationships are holding. One way we see monetary policy flow through to the economy is via the interest rate mortgage holders pay on their debts and the interest payment savers receive on their deposits. Together, these are known as the cash flow channel. This is where most of the public attention focuses at the moment. That is completely understandable. The effects are intuitive, they're quick, they're highly visible, and they're unevenly distributed. Indeed, some mortgage holders are experiencing a painful squeeze on their financing at the moment. The board and the bank are very mindful of these distributional consequences of policy. My colleague Chris Kent recently gave a speech on two consequences of the pandemic that might mean this channel might be taking a little longer than usual. During the pandemic, more mortgages than usual were taken out at fixed rates, and households accumulated large savings buffers. Broadly speaking, though, the slowdown in consumption that we are seeing so far is in line with historical relationships. Another way to frame this is that the increase in interest rates seen over the past year, together with the declines in housing prices and real incomes, largely explains the difference between current outcomes for household consumption and also the current forecasts and the forecasts we made a year ago. Another way tighter monetary policy has affected the economy is through lower asset prices and most notably housing prices. We have seen an 8% decline in housing prices since April last year. There's a wide range of estimates of what you would expect given developments in the economy since then, including the increase in the cash rate over this period. But this is in that wide range. Lower housing prices have a flow-on effect to dwelling investment. This is a small component of GDP, but it is one of the most sensitive to interest rates and the business cycle more generally. One way you can see this is via the close relationship between building approvals, that's the purple line, and the mortgage rate, that's the green line. And you can see that close relationship through history. You can also see that this time round, the timing is a little different. Approvals were unusually high in the period before rates increased, partly because home builder brought forward some activity. Combined with delays in the construction industry due to capacity constraints, this has resulted in a large pipeline of activity that is still to be completed. So the effect on actual dwelling investment from those interest rate increases could therefore take a bit longer this time to flow through. Taken over a longer period, though, we expect it to play out similarly to past tightening cycles. The exchange rate, another channel of transmission, is also about where we would expect it to be based on interest rates, both in Australia and overseas, and other key determinants such as the terms of trade. On a trade-weighted basis, the Australian dollar is around its level in early 22, when many central banks began raising their policy rates. If we had increased interest rates, the exchange rate would likely be lower, adding to inflation pressures in the domestic economy. I'll now turn to the themes coming through in the current forecasts. So let's have a look at the GDP forecasts first. Growth in the Australian economy, in Australian economic activity, has slowed at the end of last year. This is because of both the monetary policy tightening I just discussed, but also because the initial bounce back from pandemic-related restrictions had mostly run its course. We're expecting growth to remain subdued through this year as higher interest rates, the higher cost of living, and earlier declines in household wealth continue to weigh on consumer spending. Those forces weighing on consumption are competing with some supportive forces coming from the tight labour market, which results in strong growth in labour incomes, and the savings accumulated during the pandemic. How these opposing forces play out in overall growth in consumption is one of the main uncertainties surrounding the forecasts. And I just want to point out, I pointed out earlier, the error bands on forecasts, which are the blue lines. That is historical error bands, and it hasn't often included, appeared like we have now, but that's the kind of normal variation we have always gotten. So can kind of just guess a sense of where the outcomes and what range they might be. From 24, we're forecasting growth to remain below trend, but pick up a little, and you can see that at the end of that graph. As the effect of the earlier monetary policy tightening wanes, inflation moderates, and household wealth recovers. Let's turn to the labour market. In line with the usual lags, the recent softness in economic activity is expected to take some time to flow through to the labour market and inflation. The labour market is still very tight. The unemployment rate is around multi-decade lows, and it is expected to remain below pre-pandemic levels over the next couple of years. Underemployment is also low relative to historical experience. That said, the balance between labour demand and supply has started to improve recently. As the economy slows, the unemployment rate is expected to increase gradually over the next couple of years. That brings us to the outlook for inflation. Consumer price inflation in Australia eased in the March quarter. We're expecting it to decline further over this year. As I mentioned earlier, two competing forces are driving the inflation outlook: the ongoing tightness in the labour market and the high level of demand for services lead us to expect domestic inflationary pressures to continue. On the other hand, goods price inflation should ease as the resolution of supply chain issues flows through to the prices paid by consumers in Australia. We can have some confidence that goods price inflation will moderate this year. It is already doing so in our peer economies, including in categories such as audiovisual equipment. These goods were the quintessential example of the effects of the pandemic on patterns of demand and on supply chains. For example, demand increased sharply for flat-screen TVs, and wholesale panel prices more than doubled. But the increase was quickly unwound as supply chains and demand normalised. The decline in wholesale panel prices has flowed through to retail prices of TVs and other audio and visual equipment in other advanced economies, as you can see on this graph. But prices of these types of goods are yet to decline in Australia. So I want to move now to what's changed since 3 or 6 months ago. When putting together the forecast, it is often good to step back and think about the key things we've learned over the past 3 to 6 months. I've already touched on one of these, the increased confidence we have in the turnaround on goods inflation. One of the biggest changes in view has come from population growth, which has been stronger than was expected 6 months ago. This largely reflects faster than expected return of international students and working holiday makers following the reopening of the international border. But also low levels of departures are adding to this. This has affected the economy in several ways. Firstly, the higher population growth increases demand for housing. Initially, we expect this adjustment to come through higher rents and higher average household size, as growth in the population is faster than the dwelling stock. But in the longer run, there's also a boost to dwelling investment. In terms of the effect on the labour market, higher population growth by itself is expected to increase employment growth. Overall, the outlook for key labour market ratios, such as the unemployment rate and participation rate, are little changed by faster population growth. There might be differences across different regions and industries, though. The recent migration has been concentrated in students and other temporary residents, such as working holiday makers. The increase in demand for housing will therefore be concentrated in the largest cities. Similarly, the expansion in labour supply will be most evident in hospitality and other sectors that employ a higher shares of temporary residents than average. A second change in view comes from some policy changes affecting future energy costs. Following the very large increase in wholesale electricity costs last year, a large increase in electricity bills for households is due in the September quarter of this year. Regulators have announced draft determination increases to the default office for electricity prices in the eastern states in the 23-24 financial year of 20-30%. And market offers are assumed to increase by a similar amount. This is still a significant increase, but it is smaller than what we expected 6 months ago. Government policies announced since then have moderated the expected increase in energy costs somewhat. We reflected that in our February forecasts, as well as in the new ones to be published on Friday. These changes highlight a key point about some of the assumptions that need to be made when forecasting. Forecasts can only be reasonably based on the fiscal and other government policies that are already known at the time. Until those policies have been announced, and in some cases legislated, you cannot know whether and how they will affect the outlook. A third thing that has changed is that the established housing market... A third thing that has changed is that the established housing market has been a bit more resilient than might have been expected. After falling for most of last year, national housing prices have started to stabilise in recent months. That is a little earlier than most observers expected. Our assessment is that this probably reflects low supply and stronger fundamentals, such as population growth and higher rents, along with changes to the interest rate outlook. Lower housing prices generally dampen consumption, and the effects of the earlier decline in prices is still working its way through. But with housing prices seemingly stabilising a bit sooner and at a higher level than most observers would have expected, the total effect of lower housing prices on consumption will be a bit smaller. And I want to conclude now. Forecasting is a valuable tool for central bankers, but we will never be able to tell the future perfectly. There will always be new things to learn and ways we can improve as well. With that in mind, the bank will be carefully considering the recommendations made by the RBA review as they relate to our forecasting. And as for our forecasts, in the past few months, things have been turning out broadly as expected on the macro front. But the faster recovery in the population could turn out to have unanticipated or more pervasive effects. We will also be carefully monitoring how the competing forces affecting both consumer spending and the labour market are playing out, and how the easing in cost pressures coming from global supply chains translates into domestic prices. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marion. So we are going to move on to the Q&A now. We do have the Pigeonhole app and the details are on a QR code on your table. But we also have roving microphones, and I'm really encouraging people today to actually, if you're comfortable doing so, please stand up and ask a question with a mic. If you just pop your hand up, one of our CETA staff will find you and come to you. If you do ask a question with the mic, please keep it pretty brief and questions, not statements, please. And please do let us know who you are and where you're from. We do have some media in the room today, and Marion is happy to take questions from media. But again, please please ask them through the microphones and identify where you're from. I'm going to start with an opening question, but then I will throw it to the floor. Marion, you talked a little bit about the kind of breadth of data and information that you use, and one of those elements is the Business Liaison Program, which was a program I was lucky enough to be a part of a few years ago when I was at the RBA, and I know we've got some members of the team here. Could you tell us a little bit more about how that works, what sort of information you get from it, and what are some of the kind of key insights that you've got over the years from Liaison that you might not have got elsewhere?
So we have built up the Liaison program in the early 2000s. I think it's 2001, if I remember. Virginia might be able to correct me on that one. And we have offices across the country in the major states. We got one here in Perth. We have one in Queensland, Melbourne, and in South Australia, in Adelaide as well. And there are small teams that are there. We also have a team in Sydney that covers the Sydney area for Liaison. And the purpose of this program is really for us to get insights from businesses in particular on the ground of what is happening. So we're covering different sectors and we're covering different themes for us and for the board to get the best insights possible on this exercise that are called nowcasting. That is really important that you know what is here and now. That is one part we get from them. We get a lot of color on what the underlying drivers are. When you have to model something, and when you have to pick a model, it's actually really important to know what is driving a relationship. And so those insights are invaluable. Businesses also can give us a bit of an insight how they're looking, thinking about the future, and that also informs judgment we put in our forecasts. So we get a lot of that colour and qualitative measure from our liaisons, and it's a structured program. We're often going back to the same contacts. But we are also collating that information in our qualitative results, so we get what we call an index. We're putting that together. It's a Likert scale for those who are... I think anyone who's been through our representative offices knows it quite well. But it is a technique to pull that information together in a kind of aggregate sense to give us a sense where things are tracking. And I'm very pleased to be here, and I was actually here in November, the first time after lockdown too, in fact, visit our West Australian office, and Aaron's here and Stephanie's somewhere. Stephanie's over there. Not only do they kindly host me, but they set up programs for me to talk to the businesses here as well, hear what they have to say, and they're usually also interested in what I have to say, which is nice too. And that's, you know, that's an integral part for what we're doing. What are some of the insights? We're here in West Australia. I cannot be here without mentioning mining. So obviously you all know there was a huge mining boom that went on about a decade ago, give and take. It took quite a long time. And actually for us it was really important to understand what the investment profile was that was involved with that. And I remember, I think Virginia was heading the office at the time. She kept a spreadsheet with, you know, projects. Because they were so huge and big, they were affecting the aggregate outlook for the economy. And actually, it was liaison, critically, that allowed us to do that. I don't think without liaison we would have had access to those data. So that is probably one good example among many, many, many I could recount where we got information about a critical development that had impact on the aggregate, but where you just can't get the kind of standard ABS data because it's such a specific, unique event.
Fantastic. I'm sure there are some of you in the room who've been part of the liaison program, but if you're not and you want to get involved, I'm sure Aaron here would be happy to have a chat with you. This is how it helped him. Do we have any questions from the floor? Has anyone? We've got a couple of mics. No? All good. I want to talk a little bit about the accuracy of forecasting, and you put up the confidence intervals that you have, and they're pretty wide ranges. I think to people that have been involved in economic forecasting, that's not necessarily a surprise, but it might be a surprise to the broader community about how difficult it is to actually forecast even a couple of years into the future. How does the RBA kind of rate compared to other central banks or other forecasters in that regard? Are we pretty much similar kind of confidence intervals, similar kind of accuracy, or are there things that we should be doing to keep improving that?
So I would make the bold claim that I think forecasting is a difficult business for all the central banks. No one saw the recent inflation surge, at least if you go back, certainly no central bank called it out either. And that is not a surprise. So some of these errors, as I talked through, don't actually come from forecast mistakes, as in a sense that you made an intellectual mistake in your forecasting, but there's just shocks that arrive. It's very hard to predict a pandemic. And even if you are someone who's a health scientist who said a pandemic would come, you'd also need to tell me exactly when it comes for me to put that into a forecast. Or same thing with global development, the war in Ukraine that had a really big impact globally. Again, someone who knows a lot about geopolitics might have said, oh, well, I could have told you that something was brewing. Well, for me to put in a forecast, I actually need to have the date for that as well and the extent as well. And so those exogenous shocks happen to all economies, and no forecaster can overcome those in a systematic way. Are there things we can improve? Absolutely. We have published the annual review I talked about that goes to the board. We have published that, I think it was in November. Aaron, do you remember that? We've published in the November S&P, I think it was either November or February S&P. We actually published that. We sometimes publish it when we think it's particularly interesting and it's a part in the statement on monetary policy. And one of the big lessons of the last 2 years has been that our models just haven't been geared to deal with supply shocks, because we haven't had them for such a long time. You, of course, pick a model that kind of has done really well in explaining recent history, and that's the nature when your economy changes. Those models may not perform well anymore, and so one of the big learnings has been that, well, maybe supply shocks are going to be more frequent. I'm not quite sure I'm predicting another pandemic, but there are actually the other nature of supply shocks coming from the energy side. You can see that there's a link, and the governor gave a very interesting speech for those who want to see that in November, I think it was, on that topic on, do we think we're in for a future of more supply shocks? And, of course, if you think that, there's climate change, and there's a lot of evidence for that, you will have more severe weather events. And one of the supply shocks we had last year were the floods. And they were significant for inflation. So if you think those becoming more frequent, you have to gear yourself up to developing models that handle supply shock, and that's kind of the task for us going forward. We dusted off some models that do a little bit better, but we're actually also actively developing models that actually allow us to handle supply shocks better in our overall forecasting framework. It's a big task, and if I talk to my colleagues in other central banks, they're all facing that very same problem at the moment, so there's no magic thing I can take off the shelf, but it's just what we do as forecasters that we have continuous development, but that would be one I'm pointing out where I definitely think there is work for us to do.
Fantastic. We got a... We'll go Paula and then we'll go Virginia. Yeah, Paula.
Thanks, Marion. Paula Gadsby from EY. I just had a question around services inflation. So there seems to be upside risk to services inflation. And what we've seen in a lot of developed countries overseas is it's been quite sticky to bring down. How worried is the RBA about this, especially in regards to your forecast of getting inflation back to the target band by mid-2025?
Thank you very much for that question. I think if you heard the governor's speech yesterday, he did mention that has been a consideration. And in fact, you are right that we have seen the services, the domestically generated component in other countries, being a bit more persistent. And talking about bringing back to the lessons we're learning, about a year ago when in other countries, inflation picked up earlier than here. We opened later. The big question was, well, are we different or are we just later? The answer was probably just later. And I think one of the lessons was actually, well, maybe, we should have given a little bit more credence to that story as opposed to thinking, well, here's a whole lot of reasons of why we're different. So by the very same token, you could look now at that persistence of service inflation in other countries and say, well, could happen here as well. So it is definitely a significant risk. I think to the extent that we can model it, we have embedded some of that in the forecast. Services inflation does come down slower. You saw that supply-demand graph I had, and a big part of that demand persistence is coming through that domestically generated inflation that shows typically up bigger in the services sector. So that's certainly true. We will continue watching it, though, because it could play out either way. But it's certainly a risk, and we should look at that. I do point out that some of the other dynamics in the overseas economies are different. They tend to have higher wage growth than here. But again, last year, a year ago, we brought out all of those, all of those explanations and thought, well, it could be that we're different, didn't turn out. So maybe we're kind of having a bit more of an open mind this time around.
Great, thank you. Let's go to Virginia.
Thank you, Marion, Virginia Christie, Gesby, and the Economic Regulation Authority. Appreciate you going through and explaining how complex it is to forecast, and we're aware of all the challenges in doing that. Looking at the current set of forecasts, though, and coming back to the issue around inflation being back within the band of 2-3% by 2025, what's the likelihood of stagflation being experienced over that period?
Let me answer that in terms of the error bands. They clearly tell you it could happen, but the forecasts also tell you that is not our central forecast at this point. That is a risk in the current constellation. The governor has spoken about the narrow path. He has said last night he believes that we're still on that narrow path, and that narrow path is one where you bring inflation down, but you bring it by maintaining the maximum benefit of employment possible. So I can't put a number on you, but it is within those large error bands I've showed you. It is an outcome that is possible.
Great. Yep, at the back there. Thank you.
John Paulson, Cedar Life Trustee. As we all know, monetary policy is quite a blunt instrument and has the lags talked about, and also has the uneven impact on people living in the economy. What other tools? Are there any new tools emerging that might have slightly sharper scalpels to them, or is that the only tool?
If you have suggestions, we are really happy happy to hear. The one tool people typically look at is fiscal policy. It is, can be used as demand management. I do want to refer you to testimony by the governor, recent testimony where he was asked that question. And what he said is, look, typically monetary policy is, in any country, thought as being a nimble tool to use for demand management, but there is no question that there is an interaction when it comes to demand. I'm not going to comment on fiscal policy here. We're a separate entity, and we have a mandate, and our mandate is inflation, and to the extent that is demand driven, that is what our tool is actually built to do.
Great. Thank you, Alison. And then I'll get John.
Thank you. Thanks, Marianne, for coming and also for stepping in at the last minute, or we wouldn't be able to be here just now. My name's Alison Preston from the University of Western Australia. Can you just talk to us a little bit more about what you've been learning about the labour market over the last few years and through your forecasting as well? Is it behaving the way that you would have thought it? And if it isn't, what is it that's informing your judgment?
Yeah. The labour market over the last few years. So the answer to say, is it behaving like you expected? I can't really answer that question because I've never seen a pandemic in the data or otherwise, so it's very hard for me to say what my expectation would have been. But we, of course, look at it and we're learning ex post what has happened. And I think these are important learnings because they can also inform for us of what might happen in future again. One of the features in Australia in the labour market to point out, in terms of what learnings we've had, is actually we've been one of the countries where through the pandemic labour supply has increased, participation rates have increased. There's a couple of countries, and the US and the UK I could name there, where it's actually gone the other way. And I think it has helped, by and large, it has helped us, right, at a point where you have tight labour markets to have people drawn into the labour force through the participation rate has actually helped us keep some of those pressures a bit lower than in other countries. So that would be one possible learning you can do. I think it's still very early for us to draw conclusions and, you ask the question, I've been pondering a future speech once we have the full set of data to look exactly on what we can learn from this extraordinary pandemic period in terms of labour markets. What is certainly true is that the unemployment rate has been as low as it's been in 50 years, and so have been a whole lot of underemployment, and that, I don't think anyone would have predicted that if you had told them in 2018 a pandemic is coming and that is where you come out of it. 3 years later, but I think it would have been a hard ask to predict any such outcome.
I might ask a follow-up question on labour markets. Given the extremely kind of low rate of unemployment, have you been surprised by the slow pace of wages growth, and that's really taken quite a while to kind of pick up there?
Have we been surprised? I wouldn't say we have. Over the past year, by and large, if you take out, as I said, on consumption, if you take out, the interest rate increases, if you take out the housing prices and other kind of the population growth as well, actually, it's kind of turned out broadly as we had predicted. Or as we had expected, maybe not as we had predicted, since I'm not doing predictions. That's certainly true. It's a really hard question to answer, and that goes really to the question of where do you think is that point in the economy where wages and inflation start accelerating or not. Many, many papers have been written, including internally. I would say there is no single point I can point to, but there's also a whole lot of literature that actually says this could be nonlinear. And so the further you get away from it, the more your wages might behave differently. So to some extent, we're also constantly observing and monitoring how this is developing and whether it is developing as we thought or not and have an open mind. And it is that continuous improvement where you see wages growth going.
Thank you. Yep, back there. Thank you.
Jordan Murray from the West Australian. Thank you for speaking today. I think here in Western Australia, we like to think that we carry the national economy on our back. Based on the forecasts that are being put together at the moment, I was wondering if you could speak about the role that Western Australia is having in national forecasting, and then specifically what Western Australian policymakers can learn from the national forecasts.
This is a really hard question. So we're in the business in forecasting to forecast aggregates. We have one tool. We have a mandate for aggregate inflation and aggregate outcomes. And so a lot of our forecasting work is being really guided by what it means for the aggregate. That doesn't mean we're not looking at Western Australia, and I think our liaison program is kind of the key way how we gather that information, if that helps. What I can say is that I've been here during the mining boom where it felt like Western Australia was developing at quite a, had very different themes to some of the rest of the country. But what I've actually found in my recent visits here is that, you know, despite the differences, there are actually a lot of common themes coming out of the pandemic here in West Australia as well, like in the other states. That's probably how I would cast it without, you know, making this about one country, one state carrying the other states. That's just not how we think about that.
I'll take a question from Pigeonhole, which I thought was quite an interesting one. How is the RBA thinking about the use of advanced analytics and AI in the forecasting process? Is that something you're looking into?
As a really, if Lucy had been here, she'd get really, really excited about that question. So I'll try to channel. So let's take it one at a time. So we have heavily invested in data analytics. We've been building up internal expertise, and it's allowed us to do a couple of things that we, you know, wouldn't have been able to do a few years ago, particularly using the large data sets that are available at the moment. We kind of tend to publish them sometimes. They're sometimes in a statement, sometimes we have a bulletin article going at that, but we're having, you know, we're dabbling in, can you do, you go through Google and you kind of grab headlines, or you're doing text analysis, and you can see that there's academic papers out there as well, and just see whether we can learn something and whether this gives us some additional insights or corroboration of other things. So that is certainly an area that we're looking at. It's not the core of what we're doing. And the reason it's not the core of what we're doing is, as I explained through here, the forecasts aren't just about coming up with a number that may or may not be good. Because you know you're never going to hit it, what is really important is the narrative you're developing about that. So understanding what is driving it and having a logic behind the behaviour is really, really important for our job. And I'm not sure whether AI is quite helping there, but I have an open mind. If someone has an AI tool and wants to, you know, put it to the race with our forecast, we have a very open mind to, you know, to go into that sphere as well. But at the moment, we're not using it for this for that reason, that we actually really think the narrative is important, because we have to think about risks as well as the central forecast and have to be able to quantify them and understand them and understand why we're tracking along a forecast or why we're not tracking along a forecast in order to make judgments whether policy needs to be adjusted or not. So that is a much more complex thing, but I have an open mind whether AI can help us with that.
Fantastic. Watch this space, it seems. Have we got any more questions from the floor? No, good. I want to touch back on the transmission mechanism, and you talked a little bit in your speech about, you know, the time it takes for policy decisions to really flow through to different aspects of economic activity. And I think that's something that's not particularly well understood, and you know, how long some of these things take and why that is. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more detail about, you know, what is it that, you know, what's the kind of process there and why is it that things kind of take so long to flow through?
At a very fundamental level, it is because what we're observing at the end is the result of behaviour of firms and households. And so you put an impulse in that is at different interest rates, and you actually need to give it time for that behaviour to adjust. That is at an abstract level why you have lags in the air. And then behaviour of different people, parts of the economy, will adjust earlier or will adjust later. And if you play that through, you're kind of getting the whole chain of events. But at a very fundamental level, economics is about the behaviour of people, about understanding the behaviour of people. And when you're a policymaker with a tool, you basically want to influence that behaviour to achieve certain outcomes. It adds up to the aggregate. It looks like the CPI, but of course the CPI is basically the added up effect of a whole lot of businesses making decisions about prices. And that's kind of why it takes a long time to flow through. Different people will react differently earlier, later, differently. A saver will react differently to a borrower. Just at the front end of the cash flow channel, that alone, you can see that there is just lags building up that you do. So our models are trying to capture these at an aggregate level. But if you think about it that way, you can understand why the error bands any model has are actually pretty large. You know, the estimated error bands, not the broader estimate. It's just the nature of the thing we're dealing with.
A question come through on Pigeonhole, and you did you referred to this a little bit in your speech. Is, you know, we've had a lot of people on fixed rate mortgages, which are, you know, likely to come off in the fairly near future. Is that something you've incorporated into the forecast? The impact of that?
So I'm just trying to decide. We have spoken a lot about that in public and in our documents. And there's different aspects to look at it, so I'm just going to focus on the reason I'm just trying to think through which aspect I should take. So I'll just take the economic effect on how that impacts. If you think about it, you have someone with a variable rate mortgage where the, you know, the interest rate adjusts much earlier and they face their lower mortgage. Someone with a fixed rate mortgage will face that same adjustment just a little bit later. So you can take that into account, but the fixed rate mortgages actually aren't, in the scheme of things, that long. I think for Australia they are long, they're 2 to 3 years. I go internationally and speak to my colleagues from other central banks, and they say, what, they're not 30 years, right? Because there are actually countries that have much longer runs on the mortgages. And so if you look at it that way, they're actually rolling off relatively soon over the horizon. So to the extent that we can adjust for that, we will. We have done it, but we're actually not modelling the pass-through at that detailed level, but yes, so there is an element by which we're adjusting a little bit for that. But it also affects really just one channel of monetary policy, which is the cash flow channel. As I said in the speech, it is very visible because it's one of the fastest channels. But there are a whole lot of other channels, such as through housing markets, the exchange rate channel, and other channel, consumption saving channels. They take longer, but that doesn't mean that they're smaller than the cash flow channel. And so in some sense, when you add them all up, that is actually for the specific question of the transmission of monetary policy to employment and inflation, That is actually a small movement where we have it. But it is a very visible one, and it is a very important one for those households that are affected by that.
Fantastic. We've got time for one last question, if everyone did want to take last chance from the floor. No, we're all being very quiet today. Well, I will ask my question then, a quite nerdy one. We've finally got a monthly CPI indicator, which has been a long time coming. Has that assisted the forecasting process? And are there other kind of key data gaps that you'd really love to see to help you improve forecasting going forward?
I'll take the first and maybe not the second one. I have those conversations in private with the statistical office. Yes, it's been a long time. We discussed that, and I think it's just a big undertaking to do that. Has it helped us? I think it has. I think it is early days yet. It was very timely to get that. I think when you have inflation moving fast, in either direction for that matter, getting a more frequent update I think is really helpful. Because it is early, I think the Bureau of Statistics is still working underneath and refining and collecting more data and updating. We've had a box on what it looks like in the November S&P, and when you look there, you would have seen that the way it's done is that not all goods are updated every month, and so that introduces a little bit of a problem that you need to assess what information you get every month. And I think some people who looked at it at the beginning have found that it's a bit more volatile than it is the quarterly. And it's probably not surprising. Aggregation tends to kind of smooth out errors. But we do actually learn a lot, and what I have found so far is, if anything, we're learning more about the components. So there's certain components that we're actually seeing early, and so looking underneath the hood has actually allowed us to understand and get an earlier look into how some of the components are developing earlier than if we got the quarterly CPI. But with every new statistic, you actually have to learn how to deal with it, how to get the best information out of it, and I think we're still in that early period where we're trying to see how we're best reading that new statistic to get out. But it's definitely been already a really great asset to have.
Fantastic, thank you. Well, we are out of time. I hope you've all kind of learned a bit more about the RBA's forecasting process, and I'm sure everyone will be waiting for the updated forecast coming out on Friday. I'd like to welcome back Vanessa Torres to close our event.